Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, a half hour of commentary, analysis, and, as we often say, if we're lucky, a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with my good friends, Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, and, of course, Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. Gentlemen,
good to see you. Good
day.
How
are you?
How do?
Are we going to get lucky today?
Excuse me?
Are we going to get lucky to get a little insight today?
Oh, insight. Is that
you're thinking of something else?
I think it's quite clear what he's doing. When he said little insight, and then he looks at me, he's trying to tell everybody that I'm the little guy and that he's the tall guy.
Do you think that he's a little sensitive?
I think he's very sensitive.
Well, what do you know? Anyway, we're here with a live audience through the glass here this morning of the students from the New Visions Law and Government Program. This is a program for distinguished high school seniors who study current events, electoral process, and politics all year long. Their final year, they get to come into this program as opposed to going to their own individual schools for the whole day.
Well, it's quite wonderful.
It's a cool thing. So we're always glad to have the New Visions students here. We have a separate New Visions program based at the Times Union that deals with media issues. And it's a great program run by the schools in our communities. So those of you across the country who are hearing this show, rather than in New York's capital region, may wish to go and do likewise. As we sit here, I'm holding what looks like USA Today, but it is really odd because the headline is about a Mr. Martin McFly Jr. arrested for theft.
Martin McFly sounds like somebody who should be in a comic book.
Well, what do you know? Marty McFly, of course, happens to be the lead character in Back to the Future. And here we have, I'm doing this Rush Limbaugh thing.
We were just telling the students about the importance of radio versus TV, and now you're giving all these visuals that nobody can see.
Yeah, absolutely. But this was a thing that Rush Limbaugh does. He always...
Put your radios right next, listen to your radio right next to your ear, maybe
right.
You'll be able to see it.
So this is Back to the Future 2, of course, is getting a lot of attention these days.
Well, the point was that in the movie, they made reference to looking to the future yesterday as we speak, October 19th, 2015.
Yep.
It was the Back to the Future Day. And among other things that were predicted in that movie was that the Chicago Cubs were going to go to the World Series in 2015.
Supposed to be
so
the Cubs.
So it got quite a bit of play. And USA Today was mentioned in that movie, and they did their part by producing a faux edition.
A faux wrap, really, around the thing. And
what is a faux wrap?
Faux is a French word for false.
That I knew.
Oh, okay. Just glad to help a little bit here in case your PhD didn't extend to foreign languages.
Well, look, Rex, there's no sense to be jealous because I'm the only one in the room with a PhD.
But a wrap is a section that wraps around the outside of the paper. We do one during horse racing season,
for example. I hate it because it takes forever to get into my newspaper.
Yeah, well,
you're excellent newspaper.
A lot of people feel that way, but you do it because it makes money. And when you make money, then you can hire more reporters.
Yes,
right?
it's and a half of a page wrap is called a spadia, S-P-A-D-I-A, and it's typically it's typically always purchased by an advertiser who, despite the fact that you say they hate it, it's expensive.
No, I hate it.
You
hate it. I don't think they hate it.
No, they like it.
And Rex said, I was very interested, if they make more money, they can hire more reporters. But it hasn't really worked out that way. The way that it's worked out is if they make more money, they keep it.
If they, well, no, the way it works out is you make more money, you reduce your staff less than you otherwise would have to. But what is fun here is, of course, USA Today is making money off this because they have advertising supporting this wrap. That's why we did the one for horse racing, because people want to have this opportunity to be wrapped around the outside of the paper. By the way, Spadia, you as a PhD might think that that's a Latin term for wrap around or something. It's actually named after Mr. Spadia, who is a pressman who originated the concept.
I didn't know that.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I always thought it had to do with what happens when your dog is a puppy.
Well, so you can be a part of this program by sharing your thoughts. media@wamc.org is how we get email. We have one of those, in fact, from listener Andrew, who writes, at the debate, that would be the CNN Democratic debate, Anderson Cooper was trying to beat on Bernie Sanders. I think he was actually asking him a question. For being a socialist, was I the only one who screamed at the TV, but Anderson, you're a Vanderbilt?
That's true.
It's an interesting question. I mean, actually, it seemed to me a legitimate question to say, do you think America is ready for a socialist president?
Well, and the noted journalist Bill Maher, who is an avowed supporter of Bernie, had Bernie on his program last week, and he was trying to get Bernie to explain to the people who are nervous about a socialist to describe what a socialist is, a democratic socialist. And I thought Bernie failed miserably at trying to do it. So that's going to be a problem for him going forward. But my point is, this was not a Vanderbilt asking the question. It was Bill Maher, who is a supporter of Bernie.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, socialism is interesting because we are all socialists. We get library cards, socialism. We go to school, which is paid for by the state, socialism, right? So we're all socialists in a way. But we have fought several wars with socialist countries and communists. And in this country, we're still all these years later, have the specter of Senator McCarthy and the Army McCarthy hearings and all finding communists under every rock. And here comes Bernie Sanders, who lived through all of that, who's my age. He's old. And he is trying to deal with that specter because he knows he can't be president if people are still saying, socialist, bad.
But that answer that you gave was the answer that Bill Maher was looking for Bernie to give.
How do you know?
Because Bill Maher has made the point. We have Social Security, we have Medicare, we have all of these things which are socialists, and Bernie is being tarred by the phrase socialism, whereas you have just pointed out, so much of that is already ingrained in our system.
Okay, guys, so does media bear a responsibility for making this bugaboo about socialism when, in fact, as you have just so articulately put it, Ira, there is lots of socialism in this country, but the media has gone along with that, you know.
It has gone along with that, has reflected society. I mean, the fear of socialism in this country was fueled by J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI in the 1950s. That was covered, and it was actually a journalist, that being Edward R. Murrow of CBS News, who stood up finally to McCarthy when politicians were cowering in his face. But I do think that Americans are still caught in that psyche, that we still are fearful of that economic system.
Well, you know, that's a very good point, Rex. I have watched several times now the Edward R. Murrow film, the film Good Something and Good Night and, and Good Luck.
Yeah, good Night and Good Luck, right?
Good Night and Good Luck, something. And I've watched it. And Edward R. Murrow, all the awards are named for Edward R. Murrow. Schools of journalism are named for Edward R. Murrow. But in the end, his career was done in by the fact that he took on Senator McCarthy and others, and he got downgraded by Mr. Paley over at CBS. I believe that's how it happened.
That's right.
And they said, we can't have this, basically, and you have to do softer programming. And so he continued with his show, See It Now, in which he would interview Jackie Kennedy in the White House. Or
and CBS Reports continued. He did this great documentary, Harvest of Shame, that first pointed out the toll taken on migrant workers in America. And I'm proud to say, by the way, that when I was a student of documentary film at Columbia,
where you were first in your class, weren't you?
My teacher, my professor, was the editor of Harvest of Shame.
Did you interact with Fred Friendly there?
Yes, yeah, he was my professor.
Fred Friendly was his producer, Edward R. Murrow's producer, and became a very noted—
Indeed he was, and I knew him.
A giant. Oh, did you?
Yeah, indeed I did, and I thought he was a great guy. And he did a lot of behind the scenes work for Edward R. Murrow. Yeah.
Now, we were talking about the presidential race, of course, and so it's worth raising a question about the coverage of the would-be campaign of Vice President Joe Biden, the campaign that did not come to pass this time. And the question is, did the whole notion of a potential Biden candidacy get trumped up, pardon the expression, by bad reporting? Was this really more a media phenomenon than it was reality?
No, I don't think so. I think the guy, you know, we had the deathbed wish from his son who died, Beau, saying, "Dad, you should fill your hand, basically, and run for president. You've always wanted to do it." And I thought that was poignant. I think it was the kind of thing people really wanted to hear about. He is vice president of the United States, and a lot of people don't like Hillary Clinton. So when you add all of that stuff up, he becomes what a lot of people thought was going to be a viable candidate. And by the way, not that this is relevant, well, it may be relevant to what you just said, I still believe he's a candidate for president. In other words, I believe that if Hillary stumbles, and let's say the Benghazi hearings, which we're about to hear as we speak today, happen, and Hillary stumbles, or the guy who's investigating her email accounts, the prosecutor comes up with something, and she has to take a powder, then yeah. I suspect we're going to see Biden coming in.
Well, if your mom is a boxcar, you have wheels. So, you know, that's if.
Well,
that's
I agree with that opinion. I agree with you about Biden. I don't think he's out yet. But I do think that the Washington press corps in particular, the inside the beltway, where this became such a firestorm to determine whether he was going to run or wasn't going to run, you had any number of so-called reputable reporters, print and broadcasting, reporting what proved to be incorrect information as if it was fact. And it did them a great harm going forward because, you know, they were so vociferous in their belief that Biden was going to run. And the next morning he says he's not going to run. How are you going to believe anything else that these reporters are saying?
Well, that's a good point, except that I don't agree with you. In other words, for change. No, I think that Biden didn't know himself.
Yeah, but his point is that these reporters said that he was going to. Right. These reporters, you know, Ed Henry
of
Fox.
They got lots of leaks.
But they were
three
wrong.
Sources close to Biden tell me he is expected to announce he is running.
There's a reason for that. The reason for that is they were keeping it viable. I was predicting,
and
by
the press fell into it.
Why should that have been reported?
I was predicting all along he wasn't going to run because it was basically too late.
Hold on. You just told me he was running. You can't have it both ways.
No, I think he was considering a run. But I said in the end he would not run, and he is not running.
But you just said he is running.
He's not running yet. Okay.
I'm on all sides of the issue, just
remember
like the candidates.
Remember the thing about the boxcar? So the way you do that is you keep people guessing. So Mario Cuomo, as you remember all too well, Rex, when you were, as now, a great practicing newsman, you may remember that Mario Cuomo actually had the propellers of his airplane turning on the airport to deliver his nominating papers to New Hampshire on the last day. Every time he did that, he talked about the presidency, and I know because I had this program with all these years, his polls would go up. People would respect him more. So that's what Biden was doing.
Yeah, but I think the media overhyped it. And I think it's because reporters love a good story.
People talk about
the fact that reporters are supposedly biased. I think the bias is in favor of great stories. And so there was a lot of pointless speculation about a potential Biden candidacy because reporters loved the idea of there being a Biden-Clinton race. You know?
How about you, sir? I mean, you graduated first in your class at Columbia Law School.
I've heard this before.
I know this from other people. Hmm. But why would you take a tone, as my mom used to say, take a tone with reporters about having screwed this up, when in fact you probably would have done the same thing if you were sitting where they were?
Well, I'd like to think that if I was a reporter in Washington, D.C., that I would be able to digest the information that my sources provided me and be more careful than some of these reporters were in reporting this news, or at least make more emphasis on the fact that it's not a done deal. This is what people are telling me, but don't go to the bank.
But how do they know? They don't know that. And by the way,
that's exactly right.
I want to pick up on something you just said. You know, you'd like to think you could digest it. And I have great respect for your digestion
processes.
Ira.
That was a cheap shot. That was a short-term shot.
That was a shot.
A short-term shot.
You're right.
But a boom. And he fires back. It's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith here with you. You can join the conversation if you're brave enough. media@wanc.org. And we're very happy to hear from you. You know, sometimes one of the most difficult things these days is that there are lots and lots of people doing what we're doing, that is, taking shots, second-guessing the media, and because of the internet age, this is so much more viable. That is, the commentary is so visible. I often think that if you're the editor of the New York Times in particular, you've got the whole world looking at you as though you've got a target on you. Dean Baquet, the editor most recently, has been criticized for the Amazon.com coverage that is covering the workplace at Amazon, supposedly with questions about that. And then there have been some others most recently where there is a lot of focus on how the Times reports things and how they don't. And he seems to have to answer to everybody.
Well, yes, but the question is, how many people are reading those critiques? In other words, we do know that the New York Post takes every shot, P-O-S-T, I like to say, because I don't like to pronounce the word, but the New York Post takes every shot at the New York Times they possibly can. All right, some people are going to read that, but as we know, the Post readers are not exactly the Times readers. They like the pictures more. So there's a group of people that you're getting. You know, you may get a million of people or so. But that's different from, you know, Joe Schmo being a Times critiquer. Even if they're right about what they're saying, how many people are looking at it?
There was a time when newspapers were pretty much on their own in terms of being the giants of journalism, where if we were to get criticized, we could just ignore it and let it roll off our backs. Because why would you want to bring more attention to the critic than the critic initially received? And it's different today. The ability, I mean, this Amazon story is very interesting. Jay Carney, who used to write for Time magazine and then became the presidential press secretary, is now a vice president at Amazon. And the New York Times did a very long, well-researched story about working conditions at Amazon that Amazon is taking issue with. So Carney, a traditionalist journalist, a former press secretary, how does he choose to respond? He goes and posts a very long piece on a website called Medium, which I had not heard of. I'm not sure if you guys have.
Really.
But the fact that it was out there and the fact that it was Jay Carney gave him unfettered access to the world, and the New York Times felt incumbent upon itself to respond. And not only that, the response by Dean Baquet, although there was a story in the New York Times, the response was on Medium, the site on which the complaint originally appeared. Point being, it's the world that's different in so many ways in journalism, and this is just one of them.
Is that what you think?
Oh, definitely. I think that we ought to, that it is no longer just we prepare the story and present it to people. We have to recognize the fact that stories are always in process. Yeah. That instead of saying, here's the story, you have to say, here's the story right now. Here's how far we are. And readers actually need to become more perceptive. And I think this will happen over time, more attuned to the notion that what you're reading is a slice in time, the story at this point, and you have to constantly update it. Problem being that a lot of the sources who appear online to be credible are not. The traditional vetting process that reporting yields gets overwhelmed by the volume of whatever might happen to appear digitally.
So my issue with both of you is, so what? So what? So, you know, you're being critiqued by some guy with his looking up at the light bulb with his hand in his nose. That's different because I don't think a lot of people pay attention to that. You do because it's you. And we tend to take critique that comes our way as very personal. I know I do, you know, here at the radio station. But there is always recognition. So what? Who's
looking
at
that stuff? Well, the problem is that it's a drumbeat. It's a constant theme. And you know, there are any number of reasons for media to take the sword because of actions that they did, that either sloppy work or, you know, whatever. But the drumbeat of criticism has accumulated to the point that there are people who cumulatively believe these things, and it's hurt our credibility even more than we've hurt ourselves in our credibility.
You know, you talk about trying to fix a problem. Remember back to when Judith Miller was the national security correspondent of the New York Times.
And taking handouts from the State Department and
failed,
printing them.
Well, she failed to be credulous enough. She was credulous. is that if she believed too much of what her sources told her, of what the intelligence community was telling her about the run-up to the Iraq war, and the New York Times suffered, the country suffered because so many people follow the New York Times. You know, this kind of thing happens enough that we need to have vibrant criticism of the press. But you have a similar situation where the very potent New York Times food writer, Jane Brody, I think
health and food writer, I think
for years and years misinterpreted medical information so that she was counseling people to cook and eat in certain ways that she is now saying, finally, she's saying, you know, America had it wrong for a while. Well, not everybody in America had it wrong. She did.
Well, back to your original
point. She is as guilty of mishandling that data as Judith Miller is, I think, of mishandling the data from her era.
Well, let me disagree with you, Rex. Just because you're tall doesn't mean you're always right. But I have to say that you're the one who just appeared before these very microphones and intoned into them, each of these is a story as, you know, in progress. Well, you know, Ms. Brody was going with what she had at the time. The American Heart Association has, for example, changed its views on what is. So I wouldn't be that critical if I were you.
I'd just say
I wouldn't look down your nose at anybody.
A little slow to come to the realization that a lot of science writers otherwise were pointing out some years ago. So
I disagree with you.
Well, have you by chance interviewed her and you like her, do you?
Well, I'm sure I may have, but I've interviewed so many people I've forgotten who they are.
I've heard you interview Bernie 100 times.
I've interviewed Bernie 100 times.
Your forgetfulness has nothing to do with being Bernie's age, of course, yes.
No. Cheap shot at Bernie.
Oh, sorry.
And don't you worry, Rex, you'll get there too.
God willing.
I don't know that I'm going to vote for Bernie, but I think I'd vote for Larry David. So.
great portrayal, huh? Well, it's an interesting situation. We do get sensitive about criticism. But my point is that there is actually a new ecosystem evolving in journalism in which a story needs to be constantly modified. We had a story last week that appeared in the Times Union in which our first online version of the story that was posted around 10 a.m. cited a source, according to documents provided to the Times Union by, quote, a Democrat operative. In subsequent conversation with editors, the reporter thought, you know, I should modify the attribution a little bit.
Interesting, because this is something that really bothers me.
But, you know, once it's out, once an attribution is out there, it's out. There's no getting the toothpaste back into the tube.
Have we changed the rules, Rex? In other words, in the old days, you demanded as an editor, right? You demanded to know from the person who didn't want to identify the quote, who the quoter. But the editor sort of had to know that this was for real. Now I think
our rule is that an editor needs to know who the unnamed source is.
Mm-hmm. And there are some reporters. I'm not going to name names here, but there are some that I don't respect. But who every day, every time they write, it's a Republican and he's a good one, or a top Republican or a distinguished Republican. One can only scratch their head and say, I hope he's not making it up.
But I would submit that the example that Rex gave is not a new example for newspapers. The difference is now you are able to write that initial story, post it, and then update it any number of times over the next X number of hours.
Including your mistakes, Ira.
But in the old days, depending on what your deadline was, at 9 o'clock at night, if you had that story, which was the story that you posted at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it had Democratic operative in it, you may well have said, "Okay, we're going to go with it," and it would have appeared in print the next day, and it would have taken you 24 hours to consider whether that was the right way to describe it.
Yeah, we have to make decisions the way news radio has for a long time. You know, we have to decide really quickly now. You don't have time to say, you know, well, let's talk about this a little bit. Is this really the right way to identify? You just can't do that.
But I love the way the New York Times does it, because what happens is they're forever making corrections. Mm-hmm. And they say, abhor was spelled without an H or whatever. and this gives them credibility because they're saying in an earlier time.
Well, there was a time when newspapers would not print corrections, or they would print them on page 46. And now most newspapers are upfront about printing corrections and, in fact, solicit the corrections to make sure that we do get it right.
But you use the word, Ira, print there. You said print. I think that obviously, this is just one more reason why now that we're in the era of digital, that it's much easier to do this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Easier to make the changes. Yes. Easier to update.
Thanks for that.
Well,
the good
newspapers are if they post a story that has an error in it, when they redo the story on the bottom of the story, they'll say this is a different story than the first one we printed.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. This is why.
Yep. Explains it. So a lot more topics that we could discuss with all of that, and actually we'll have to do some of that live momentarily with our New Visions Law and Government program students, because we've reached the end of our half hour.
Oh,
here.
Say it isn't so.
It is so. It is so. Alan Shartok and Ira Fussfeld and Rex Smith, that would be the professor, the publisher, and the editor. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the day. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.